I welcome you to this evening's, I was going to say concert or entertainment or something. I shan't say that. On behalf of the Vancouver Institute, to our almost end of our season, we only have four more lectures. Before I open and introduce Sir Stuart Hampshire to you, I'd like to take a moment to comment on the changes this week at the university as they affect the Institute. As most of you will know, the president of the university is the honorary president of the Vancouver Institute. This has been the case since the Institute was founded nearly 70 years ago. In resigning as president, Dr. George Peterson has relinquished the formality of his tie to us as our honorary president. I think it appropriate on behalf of the Institute to thank both Dr. George and Mrs. Joan Peterson for their demonstrated interest and actual support for our work. In the relatively short time that they have been with us, only some 22 months, it's very easy to say with sincerity that they will be both missed very much. In respect of Dr. Peterson's successor, Dr. Robert Smith, we all welcome his appointment as our acting honorary president. We greet him as an established and old friend of ours. On behalf of the executive, the council, the members at large, I want him to know that he has our active support and, if he wishes, access to our podium. We are all, I'm sure, quite prepared to wish both Dr. and Mrs. Peterson, Dr. and Mrs. Smith, Godspeed in their new responsibilities. I remind you, I'm very glad to see we have an overflow audience. I wouldn't worry about sitting in the aisles. If you don't mind it, I'm sure no one else does except the fire marshal. He doesn't often come, fortunately. I want to remind you about memberships, and again, for those of you who don't know, announce that we have been given a number by the Department of National Revenue, which will permit us to deduct, or permit you to deduct, and those who make donations to the Institute to deduct from their income such donations. We regard this as a very important step forward. It makes no change to the structure of the Institute, but it does give you a small but important incentive to supporting our work. And I ask you to bear that in mind if you are not members. Now, our speaker tonight, Sir Stuart Hampshire, while born in healing Lincolnshire and therefore mortal, seems to me to be close to those godlike people who start at the top, not content with that. They stay there, and stay there through several careers and, in fact, a whole professional life. Our speaker has spent the major part of his professional life lecturing and writing as a philosopher. The London Times, when it published the honors list, which carried his knighthood, said simply, "Knight Bachelor, Stuart Newton Hampshire, Philosopher." He was then warden of Wadham College, but it's only half the story, as I will attempt to demonstrate it in the minute or two that I have. He was educated at Repton Public School and Balliol College, Oxford, graduating in 1936. As he had a first, he sought and was given permission to write the competitive fellowship examinations for All Souls College. Now, most of you will know that All Souls is a wonderful college for academics as it has no students. He was elected the Humanities Fellow for that year. And he has, of course, remained a fellow ever since. He remained at Oxford and at All Souls until the war. Now, the next 9 years saw him involved in two levels of government service. The first, of course, was war service with the Army and the Foreign Office. The second was a very interesting term as a political attaché and a personal political assistant to later Sir Philip Noel Baker and later still a Nobel Peace Prize winner. Philip Noel Baker was then a Secretary of State in Clement Attlee's cabinet. Our speaker spent the very hot summer of 1947 working, as he says, very hard indeed, with his minister in Paris, assisting in the drafting of the Marshall Plan. That work done, he returned to philosophy. And the next 23 years he spent as an active working philosopher. These years fall loosely into two periods of lecturing and writing. The first is the British period of about 16 years, and the second is the American period of about 7 years. During the British period, he shuffled back and forth, is his phrase, between Oxford and London. Two separate appointments at London, first at University College, at which at the end of which he published his first book in 1951 entitled Spinoza. There then followed two Oxford fellowships, the first of 3 years at New College and the second a return to All Souls of 5 years. The last half of his London term saw him return to the University of London as the incumbent Grote and holder of the Grote Chair of Philosophy. He left this chair in 1963 to go to Princeton and to begin his American experience. He put it to me this way. I'd been at Oxford and at London. Suddenly I thought, at age 50, why not? Princeton was a very prestigious institution. Its Department of Philosophy was selected year after year as outstanding. It was understood that I would head the department at the end of my first year. Now, when I arrived, the students were described to me as apathetic. And all went well for 2 years, and I began to hear rumblings. One day I found myself chairing a meeting while 3,800 students and faculty voted to go on strike. He described it to me as not exactly a riot. But by 1970, of course, everything had gone quiet again, but he was thus equipped to be elected head of Wadham College, Oxford. He says of Wadham that he spent 14 years there, the longest time I've stuck at anything. He was, he says, forced to retire by reasons of age in July 1984. So he thus comes to us at the joint invitation of both the philosophy departments of UBC and Simon Fraser. He's not previously been in Vancouver. He's only been here 2 days and leaves tomorrow. So say nothing about the weather. It's suited to those, in my view, who are used to living at the top. And welcome, Sir Stuart Hampshire.
Well, I'm a little embarrassed by the fullness of the introduction, because I am today to say something about the interweaving of philosophy and political experience, and that involves me in looking back a little on my own experience, because I think that the autobiographical element is indispensable in any such theme. But let me assure you that the hero, or more correctly, the heroine of the occasion, will be philosophy and not I. But it is a fairly long trajectory from 1933 to the present time, and that was the year when I became an undergraduate. We could call this the story of changing expectation, and the story begins at Balliol College, Oxford, in 1933, which was some years after the doors had closed on the Kreditanstalt Bank in Vienna and the Wall Street crash and so forth. But we of that generation, undergraduates, often melodramatically said that we were the post-slump generation. And we also sometimes melodramatically said that we were the pre-war generation. It was the period of throwing food into the sea and burning coffee. It was a period of Roosevelt and the WPA and the destitution of the unemployed in the USA and Jarrow marches in England. That was the background of my 3 years as an undergraduate. But there was another feature of it, namely the coming to power, as you will recall, of the Nazis in 1933, and the, to us or to me and to my friends, shocking attitude of the then Conservative Party to the Nazi government in Germany, namely an attitude of toleration, attempt to appease them, which seemed to all of us a betrayal of all traditions with which we were familiar. But, so far a gloomy story, but there was another thing, namely philosophy itself, and more particularly the philosophy that came from the Vienna Circle, subsequently to be called logical positivism. a dogmatic form of skepticism which clean and pure and sharp seemed to solve the problems of disciplined thinking in the way in which philosophers time and again have thought that these problems could be solved. Descartes had thought it, Kant had thought it, and we thought it, reading Erkenntnis, which was the journal, the regular journal from Vienna, edited originally in Vienna, edited later from Holland, which we read, we being a small group of four or five people. We never were taught by our tutors, because our tutors disagreed with logical positivism very naturally, since it was a consequence of the doctrine which I espoused with enthusiasm, that my tutors had wasted their life on inquiries which had no substance and couldn't conceivably make sense. So, naturally enough, there was a tension, and we taught ourselves. The senior classical scholar of my year was, in fact, a Marxist, but some of us were kept away altogether from those doctrines by the clean severity, the sharp outlines of logical positivist doctrine. Now, I'll come back in a moment to what those doctrines were, because they have had a lasting effect upon me as upon the whole philosophical community. At least I can say that my political creed in those days was the belief that capitalism in Europe would probably destroy itself in a world war, and that there would be socialist governments in Europe after that. And secondly, that the Labour Party, in conjunction with the unions, would in England construct something which would be a social transformation of all that we had known in the past, and more specifically of the divisions into classes in English society. Now, the first of these beliefs has proved almost wholly mistaken. It was recalled at the time, when I first went to All Souls in 1936, that Churchill, I was not present on the occasion, but he was in the common room at All Souls, and somebody said, "But Mr. Churchill, if you wish to resist the Germans, we shall have a war, and that will be the end of civilization." And he allegedly replied on this occasion with a large glass of whiskey next to him, "What you mean is the end of stocks and shares." We thought, many of us thought, that it would mean the end of stocks and shares, but it did not. The second belief is not entirely mistaken, because in the post-war years, in the immediate post-war years, in the Attlee government, a very definite change was made, change, as I firmly think, for the better in social arrangements, in particular the introduction of a health service and related measures which are not easily reversed. Nonetheless, there was no large structural change in society as a whole. The same kinds of school teaching, the same kind of boys as when I went to school, let's say with the same origin, in 1925 to English boarding sense. Same even up to this day, except that women, girls, go as well. But otherwise, things are very much the same as might have been expected only by someone who'd never had the hopes, ambitions, and expectations which I and my contemporaries had. So much for those years, the political background and the philosophical foreground for me. Then, after the war, I returned to philosophy, but after a particular interval in which I had been able to study to some degree at first hand the change in political events, the change in political tendencies, more strictly, which could depend upon mere personality and mere chance. And that was the case in the summer to which your chairman alluded of 1947, when the Marshall Plan turned around the whole prospects which Europe had. And I was privileged to be there during that period in Paris, during that hot summer, in which just a few persons coming together made not in the plan itself, but in the initiation of the plan, all the difference. After that, in a few years, there was the Wirtschaftswunder, Erhard's policies in Germany, and a complete change in the direction of European affairs. Now, after 47, there was a great period in philosophy which lasts until this time. And that it was a great period is hard to communicate to persons who didn't study philosophy before the Second World War. The so-called analytical movement in philosophy, still alive today, after 40 years, has transformed the position of philosophy in the general culture of my country, and I think of English-speaking countries as a whole, not excluding yours and the United States. Before the war in Britain, philosophy was an academic, strictly and narrowly academic subject, which was thought of as teaching young men who were to go into the professions, more specifically into the civil service and into the law and cognate professions, but with to teach them to think clearly and to argue and to write clearly, but had little influence in the general culture of the country. You couldn't have asked an editor in those days to name anyone who was a philosopher other than Bertrand Russell, who was a man of genius and in any case involved in many activities outside philosophy. After the war, academic philosophers were, to the great irritation of a great number of people, everywhere, on the BBC, in weekly journals, wherever you went, people were arguing about philosophical subjects and constituting themselves a kind of thought police, telling people what was intellectually respectable and law-abiding in intellectual terms and what was not. Philosophy itself made great advances in these years, really great advances. And we still have these advances with us. Philosophy went away from the old dogmatic skepticism of the Vienna Circle, which had represented all knowledge outside the natural sciences and outside mathematics as to some degree suspect, except insofar as that knowledge approximated to the standards of verification and exactitude to be found in the natural sciences. It was the Vienna Circle's doctrine in those days of clean hope, intellectually speaking, was that outside the natural sciences, common sense would be restrained by a respect for scientific method, metaphysical speculation would be ashamed of itself and disappear, and moral philosophy would become vastly more tolerant and more respectful of the emotional origins which were its basis. Now, after the war and through various personal influences, but principally the influence of Wittgenstein, this view, which was essentially a view of a total overseeing of human knowledge and the human disciplines, philosophers came to recognize separate areas of the human spirit in Hegelian terms, and to think of philosophy as naturally flowing like a river into the sea through an estuary which has many little rivers attached to it. Philosophy of law, philosophy of language, philosophy of psychology, philosophy of physics, philosophy of biology, political philosophy, and so forth, each with their own practitioners who would bring to philosophy a knowledge derived quite outside philosophy and bring philosophy, therefore, into contact with the rest of the university, if it was a university, and the rest of the intellectual community. In a way, this was a partial integration of the polemical side of the analytical movement, which was in its nature polemical, because it wished to remove the merely imprecise elements in human thought to the periphery and not make imprecision a subject of separate study by philosophers. Nonetheless, this division or breaking up the separate little rivers going into the sea were a realization of the best intentions of those splendid men in Vienna who had started it all, who were dedicated philosophers, somewhat anti-clerical in their tendency, radical, serious, and in no way afflicted with what was so distressing to many of us at Oxford, no doubt it was priggish of us to be distressed, the amateurishness of British philosophy. So there was a real and important change in the status of philosophy, not least, as I shall try to show, in relation to politics. Now, in 1971, together with a very famous Polish Marxist who now comes quite often to this country, former Marxist, Leszek Kolakowski, a philosopher, he and I decided that we ought to get together, not exactly secretly, but without publicity, socialists from various countries in Europe who would discuss a problem we would put to them. Why the horror of totalitarian socialism? Why the horror of Eastern Europe? Was it the doctrine? Was it Marxism? Or was it some kind of accident of history? What had got wrong? What were with the disappointment of what, after all, was a 19th century dream? Why had it ended in this nightmare of greyness and repression? Well, at that conference, it's not pertinent to my theme tonight to say what exactly happened at that conference, but one thing happened to me. It occurred to me very vividly that even those of us who had never had any interest even or any active interest in Marxism as a possibly true doctrine, even those of us who belonged to the stodgy anti-intellectual ranks of the British Labour Party had long been presupposing that we could somehow, somewhere, find an effective and useful social science, and that this could be the basis of rational planning. One had somehow thought that there was such a thing flourishing in the world called social science, and that it yielded usable results. But then in the late 60s, roughly at the time just before this conference, it had been proved that in England, at least, that we didn't even know enough about human beings and the way they live and the way they feel to plan a successful housing estate. The high-rise buildings were being pulled down, and the whole program which had led to them, and led to them with some social philosophy behind it, was, but in actual practice, proved to be founded on a set of elementary mistakes which could be called mistakes in social science. Now, at that moment, the radical skepticism of the old pre-war days, the logical positivist kind, returned to me. Surely there must be philosophical reason why social science is not within our reach and probably will not be, at any rate, in the near future. And that caused me to go back even more and reflect that there was no single event in my time, in these 50 years, which really was a large change in the world, which anybody of note, whether academic or in the world of journalism, had predicted. Nobody whatever, because I've looked into it, predicted the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, which projected, really caused or led forward the immediacy of war. Nobody predicted that. Nobody predicted the Sino-Soviet split. Nobody predicted the Wirtschaftswunder, the Erhard expansion of the German economy. In fact, most of the persons that I would discuss these things with at that time predicted it would lead to total disaster, which it did not. Nobody predicted any other major change, for example, the relative decay of the Communist parties of Western Europe. Nobody predicted the present phase of conservative governments and conservative support for conservative governments in Britain and the United States. In other words, there was a real failure to apply anything which a logical positivist would call a worthwhile theory to social change and political phenomena. So, when I reflected on this, it seemed to me necessary to go back and think again about the place of theory and the place of morality in one's own, in my own, and I suppose in persons I should try to persuade, their political convictions. Now, theories of various kinds, including the theories that we all paid attention to in the 30s, are designed to show that certain changes are in the nature of things. Now, the kind of theories that we have are theories that show that the success of free enterprise economies, when they are successful, lies in the nature of things from some theoretical reason, so-called trickle-down theories. When I ask myself why I do not believe them, and why I do not even think that it is worth reading the books and articles in which the theories are stated, I find myself returning to these skeptical thoughts of the 30s, to the logical positivist claim that unless you have a theory which yields predictions, and timed predictions at that, or roughly timed predictions, then it isn't clear that your theory serves any purpose at all. What then is one to say of the vast proliferation of political science, political commentary, the libraries that are full, and no sign that these theories, any more than the theories of the Communist Party before the war, the theories derived from Marxism, yield a result? Why these failures? Now, I think the answer to these questions is along these lines. It seems to me that we have an overwhelming need, which is fundamentally an emotional need, to make sense of our contemporary social and political experience, to find a purpose or direction, or failing that, at least a pattern of some kind within the events. They must make sense in the sense of pointing in some direction, we feel. And I use the word feel advisedly. I think it is a matter of feeling. The great events of our centuries, the massacres and wars, products these of human wills, which have been much worse than in most preceding centuries, cannot, we feel, be bare contingencies without structure or meaning, pointing nowhere. There must be, taking a century as a whole, some tendency, something for all the suffering, the lapses into barbarity, the destruction, and the manifest absurdities of our present defense policies. There must be some sense to it, a pattern. Otherwise, it seems that our experience in this century is one of intolerable waste, unless some expected climax or outcome finally redeems the confusion. Now, the notion of making sense, I think, falls into two distinct kinds, and here I simply draw, as philosophers present will know, on our tradition, philosophical tradition. The first sense I've already alluded to, a direction, a teleology, and above all, perhaps, a redemptive teleology, that is, one that picks out, as Marxism does and as Christianity does, an outcome, a climax, a point, a story, to tell a story of mankind. Now, the secular descendants of the Jewish or Christian stories of mankind and of the redemption of mankind were vastly influential among us in universities before the war. That is, the stories told by Hegel, by Marx, by Saint-Simon, by positivists such as Kant. And they all had a linear conception of human history, leading in each case to the redemptive moment. And the massacres and wars had a point, were not mere contingencies, not pure waste. So to speak, like some hero, like Siegfried in the forest, or other heroes, we were going somewhere. There was sense in it. That is one way in which one is under a great pressure to make sense of contemporary experience, while over the past, one is ready to be more judicious and to withhold the emotion that requires that sense is made. This, then, you might say, is the kind of making sense which lies in the prophetic tradition. Now, I'm sure I do not need, at this stage in thought, to argue for the unacceptability of theories of history in general, and linear theories in particular. There is no sacred or prophetic history which has any warrant outside supernatural warrant, but has no warrant in experience, if only because mankind, in all its separate units and separated developments, is not yet a genuine unity, except for the biologist. There is no such satisfactory clear thing as the history of mankind. The second kind of making sense is represented by the old 18th century Enlightenment, and also by my inspirers, the logical positivists. Specifically, the making sense which the social sciences might offer, specifically sociology and psychology might offer, as usable applied sciences to be the basis of rational planning. But they haven't come up with propositions which we can use. Not a single new, true, and important proposition has emerged from sociology. And when recently an inquiry was done in England where we wrote around to everybody, the government caused everybody to be consulted as to whether the Social Science Research Council should come to be reduced in its emoluments on the grounds that social science had less priority than some other sciences and then the humanities. And what emerged from the inquiry was that sociology is of great value, and the so-called scientific study of society is of great value in destroying certain common sense assumptions in sociology. For example, we all go around with sociological beliefs such as that delinquency is a product of broken homes and so forth, which is a natural thing to believe, just happens not to be true. And there are a great number of common sense sociological propositions which are genuinely dangerous because policy is made on their basis, which sociology very valuably shows by careful use of statistical methods not to be true. And in that sense, sociology is and remains an important discipline. I hope I'm not offending sociologists by these propositions. It's still the case that the kind of sociology you would need for confident planning is lacking. Now, the reason is the same, I think, in both cases, that these, whether the teleological account or the account that emerges from the Enlightenment doctrine of social science as the way to future planning, the doctrine that you get in Condorcet and countless thinkers of, well, not countless, a number of thinkers of the 18th century, all this depended on thinking of humanity as a distinct entity above the biological sphere, above the sphere of medicine and biology. And that involves a degree of abstraction from the contingencies of different cultures and different stages of development and from different languages, which is unacceptable if precise results are to be expected. If we abstract from the differences between languages, ways of life, and systems of thought, we find that we have little usable knowledge above the biological level. And natural languages and distinct ways of life are not themselves objects of strictly scientific study in the way of my old masters. That is, the kind that yields precise predictions, as opposed to yielding various kinds of translation, interpretation, and so forth, histories of a non-scientific kind. Non-scientific in the sense that they don't propagate statistically or experimentally confirmed laws and deduce from them predictions. So that we have no reason to have confidence in linear theories of human development or in philosophies of history in the 19th century sense. And skepticism about social science leaves one in a position of looking once again at the origin of one's political convictions and to find where now they might make sense given the disappointment of expectation. I won't say disappointments of hopes and ambitions or disenchantment with the original hopes that one had in the 30s, but certainly disenchantment in respect of expectations and the degree to which you could look for reliable tendencies. First, it seems to me that specific moral truths applicable to political policies, convictions, opinions, if you like, are more rationally coercive if worked out with some degree of care, as it goes on, I'm proud to say, in philosophy departments, are less discredited by recent history than any theories of the type I have discussed. For example, a conviction that the relief of poverty or the lowest 20% in standard of living should have been the first charge on the national income after defense, and that one should have rested the policies that one thought the right policies in the years immediately after the war on some such proposition, and that the criterion for assessing an economic system is the rate of advance of the bottom 20%. This seems to me to be a kind of thought that one can rationally defend in a prolonged argument without being involved in attaching too much weight to theories of human affairs which rest on a flimsy foundation when it comes to looking at the chances and actualities of politics. In other words, I feel rather that the mistake that was made certainly by me and by my contemporaries would be taken in by the appeal of the notion that somehow Marxist socialism or things that were deviant versions of them were in some sense scientific. Scientific because they gave a sense and an order and they had some intellectually totalitarian claims, when the simple propositions of Proudhon were probably better founded. Secondly, and not unrelated, as all philosophers will know, as philosophy itself, and particularly the philosophy of language, philosophy of law, philosophy of science have developed, it's been all our experience to acquire an enormous respect for chance, for the unpredicted and the unpredictable in human affairs. The old pre-war positivist had a respect for natural science, which they associated with a respect for determinism, which made them optimists about social science also. But in fact, in my small, intermittent experiences of practical affairs, it seems to me that the part of chance and the part of tendency, those two notions we need to understand human affairs, and I agree the notion of tendency is far from clear, these seem to me to give a better account of what happened, say, in the summer of 1947, where the personal interests of certain persons, such as Marshall in the United States, George Kennan of the Central Policy Review staff, Bevin and Oliver Franks in Britain, and a remarkably creative person called Marjolin in France, who was a civil servant in the Plan Monnaie, they came together and they prevented, by the action which was happened to be perfectly timed, and one has to say happened to be perfectly timed, because it wasn't at all the case that they knew that it was perfectly timed. They just had a feeling that this should be done, and there were the people to do it. Walking around the British Foreign Office in those times, there was a famous undersecretary, I'd better not mention his name, who used to say, we'll all be reduced in 5 years' time to eating bread and potatoes. And so it seemed. So it seemed. And it was just the right critical intervention at the right time. As during the war, a single mistake by an operator on a German naval cipher might make all the difference to the U-boat war in the Atlantic. This element of chance, given there is a tendency, is something which has become respectable even in the portals of the philosophy of science. I have lost belief long ago in determinism in history or in human affairs generally. And scientists now argue that we have no reason to believe in the uniformity of nature, or that the same methods that are applicable in physics are applicable in every other part of the natural order, which was, for us of the pre-war positivist inclination, an article of faith. So, the famous contrast between chanciness and indeterminism in human affairs might not be any longer valid. And the idea of the heavenly bodies setting the pattern for the operations of society and operations everywhere, namely the majestic regularity, may be a mistake. So I think my conclusion is that we should resist the impulse towards total world pictures and comprehensive theories. So, looking back on the years 33 to 36, I seem to myself now to have come round in a full circle, guided by philosophy and a little misguided by it, as is the inevitable product of being guided by anything, and by the arguments and insights which at the time seemed to me the strongest. In the 30s, the strongest arguments pointed to the impregnability, the objectivity, the, as it were, aesthetic hardness and pleasingness represented by the natural sciences and their methods, more particularly the methods which were presumed to be the methods of physicists. This was the ideal and the model, alongside mathematics and the aesthetic observation of the environment. By comparison, moral convictions and beliefs were dismissed as largely subjective, as expressions of emotion, as irreducibly private and requiring no great rational support or examination. I think now that where politics is concerned and the whole sphere of public life, this was upside down. It is true that the natural sciences and a fortiori mathematics cross all frontiers. And this is what led the men of the Enlightenment to hold that the future of the human race, as a whole, as to constitute humanity as a species above the biological level, you could do it only through the natural sciences, because they cross frontiers, they cross languages, they cross cultures, and humanity is united in the understanding of them from the North to the South Pole, across all the different languages, different traditions. So if humanity was to be united and not to destroy itself, then it must be on, this was the 18th century claim, Kant's claim, the claim of the Enlightenment, it must be primarily, well, the claim of the Enlightenment, Kant is a rather more complicated case, that it must be on this basis. But it seems to me that the claims of justice and fairness see that the old social contract arguments that we can bargain with a sense of fairness and must learn to do so across all barriers are true. I think that precisely the development of philosophy and the philosophy of language has led to an understanding of the possibility even of a comparative linguistics that looks for an underlying common basis of all languages. We now have to establish, certainly at the international level, some notion of fairness in bargaining, in making deals, if the race is to survive. It may survive or it may not, depending on whether the governments succeed in this enterprise. We can't predict, the heavens may fall, but if any attempt is made, at least the time will not have been wasted. So I would say, looking back on this arc of time, that I am not unrepresentative in having been deceived by the notion of making sense, of looking in the 19th century way for a general progress of mankind, or if not that, for a linear development of some kind. And then in the years since the war, and during the war for the matter of that, when it's proved quite impossible to put together the various strands, the unexpected strands that come from the variety of human populations, the variety of nations, when we grasp this, then we lose that hope. But I think losing that hope and being disappointed by our relative incapacity to control the forms of social change, which in those days we had hoped to control, then I think if we come to terms with that, we're less under illusion than we were. Now, that is a story based only on a personal experience, but I think the vicissitudes are not altogether unlike the common experience of those who tried to bring theory to bear on passing events and then found their expectations disappointed.
And then you can
so we do questions, sir.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's no overflow, is it? No. Sir Stewart has agreed to take questions. If they're too complicated, I'll ask him to intervene.
Yes.
Sir Stewart, you talk about the Marshall Plan being pure chance. And yet I understood the United States was anticipating a severe depression after the war and had planned some stimulation of industry. And therefore the Marshall Plan was not just pure chance, it was a necessity for the survival of our equitable economic system.
Yes.
Can you repeat?
When I say pure chance.
You should repeat the question.
Oh, yes. The question is this. Isn't it wrong to say that the Marshall Plan was pure chance, since the United States, at least, had a need at that time for reviving industry, and that led naturally to the thought that the industrial partner and the possible market needed to be revived, which is certainly so. Now, I may have use the words pure chance. One has a tendency. I'm speaking from notes, and I don't write down everything exactly as I say it. So I may have said pure chance. What I intended to say was that there are certainly tendencies and forces that you see in a situation like that in summer of 1947, in the spring actually, when the initiative began, that you see the body of interest. You saw, I'm sure I said that Marshall had an interest, Bevin had an interest, and all the central policy planning staff which had been set up with Kennan and Nitzer, people like that at that time, they had a particular policy and a role which they wanted to exploit and so forth. There were all these forces, tendencies, interest. Furthermore, there was a general tendency in the United States of the kind that you mentioned, namely that the possibility, which is a real possibility of the collapse of European economies, more particularly the German one, was something which really would have been a disaster for them, even apart from strategic interests. So I'm not saying that this was a matter, so to speak, of chance in the way it might be a chance two people meet in the street, only that it's not the extraordinary success of the outcome could not have been predicted had it not been those particular people at that time. After all, the whole operation took 2.5 months to produce a report, to collect all the statistics, to go into the report, to submit it to, the submission to Congress took a little longer, but the design of the report, and which involved finding out how many raisins are grown in Turkey and how many tomatoes are grown in North Africa, and putting all this together, there were separate reports under food, steel. It was a vast enterprise, and it was performed by something like 8, 10, 15 persons on each national delegation, and the whole thing had to be synthesized and presented to the American Congress in a political form which would be acceptable to them. I mean, for example, we used to alternate the phrase full employment, which is a left-wing phrase, with sound finance, which is a right-wing phrase. So it was a golden rule. You had to have one in successive sentences, and so forth. So it might not have succeeded. It came off to an extraordinary degree. I mean, it was amazing that it had come off. That's all I meant. And it turned the whole situation around.
Yes, that is fair.
Is there now a logical consistency in applying standards of prediction that assist in the physical and natural sciences, the artificial laboratory, applying those standards to the social sciences, which have to exist in the real world? After all, the chemist develops a product in the laboratory that works perfectly well. You introduce it into the real world, and you wind up with a major pollution problem.
Yes. That's a point which is absolutely valid. Was it heard yet? I suppose so.
No.
The point is this. Is it not inconsistent, or at any rate wrong, to apply the standards of evidence and proof that are applicable in chemistry, where the chemist can perform experiments in a laboratory controlling the conditions outside the casual conditions of the real world, while in the social sciences you can't isolate yourself experimentally for the sake of experiment from the real world, or generally not, among other reasons, because there are moral objections to experimenting on persons. That's an entirely valid point, and it's true that the founders of, the chief propagators of the ideals of social science, such as Mill, were aware of this point and made it. Even so, there are methods of investigation, roughly, and I'm sure that many people here know much more about it than I do, roughly the use of control groups and statistically controlled experiment, which are applicable in the social sciences, and are widely used in the medical sciences. And the yield in the medical sciences, where equally the point is for the most part valid, I mean, the amount of medical experiment in controlled conditions must be fair. Well, it can't be all that great. But there are other quasi-experimental methods, principally of a probabilistic kind, where you would have supposed that some interesting truths of the kind that Durkheim and other social scientists look forward to, Weber, would emerge. But no such truths have emerged which are new, true, and important. Though I do think that that's not an argument against the existence of sociology, for example, or one of the social sciences, for the reason I gave, that we all do believe and can't help believing we've got to have beliefs, false beliefs. We do have false beliefs about what goes with what in the social sphere. And sociology has been very valuable in different parts of itself, in showing, for example, that race prejudice doesn't vary, interestingly or statistically significant manner, when there are a great number of foreigners or people who might be thought the target of it. You would naturally assume this is so. It isn't. And so forth. There are very valuable negative results. But the project of getting, interesting positive laws which would enable you to forecast that in this part of England, France, Canada, you have to build this kind of housing rather than that, one would have supposed that it would be possible, but the variables are too many. At any rate, we do rather lack it. I remember architectural schools were set up just after the war, and it was supposed they would be guided in the design of railway stations, hospitals, housing estates, by actual hard scientific investigation of persons' habits. But it's proved very, very difficult to get such guidance. And of course, I know nothing about.
Can we repeat the question?
Conditions here. I'm sorry?
Could you repeat the question?
Oh, sorry, yes. The question is, what is the relation between the monetary policies or economic policies more generally of governments in the United States and England at the present time, conservative governments, and also here, and education? What is the effect on education of these policies? I very strongly suspect the effect is different in all those three countries, but one thing is common, namely that there is less money made available for education in all three. I don't know about Canada, at any rate, from the United States, where I temporarily am, and England, where I normally am, that the less money is made available for education, and not only for higher education, but more grave still for my country, for Britain, for elementary and secondary education. And in the United States, there is a very high rate of illiteracy, very high. And in England, there is a lesser rate, but there is a definite group of quite a large section of the age group, I'm told by experts in these things, who are educationally disadvantaged. And the special provision which was being made for them in English schools can no longer be made because of the cutting of money, and that produces manifest social evils apart from objective injustice
it will produce great evils of a unemployable section of the population and all the unhappiness and division that that produces. So I think particularly at that end of things, it's really a very, very grave situation. Whether I disapprove of applying criteria of economic efficiency to matters of this kind, but I have a hideous suspicion that the nature of modern technology is such that the provision of an undereducated 25% might not have an immediate effect on industrial efficiency and hence on conservative thinking. That's a particularly sinister fact, because it's very possible that modern technology in a non-factory age can tolerate a society in which there are discarded persons for educational reasons whose natural endowment or circumstances prevent them entering the higher part of the industrial process or the commercial process. That's a very sinister thing. So I think the whole period we're going through is a very alarming one. That's what causes one to go into these retrospective wonderings about what went wrong. I think it is very alarming, is my answer to your question.
You used the word linear a few times in your talk. Could you elaborate on that linear theories of history? How do you use the word?
Well, I can't see. Where's the person?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. I repeat it. Sorry. I keep on forgetting. Linear. I've asked what I meant when I used, as I did more than once, the expression linear theories of history. Well, what I meant was theories of history which prescribe for humanity as a whole, that's say, persons at all stages of development, must be in one phase or another of a single story which is applicable to all humanity, the obvious case being Kantian positivism, which says that you pass from a religious stage to a quasi-scientific stage and an enlightened scientific stage. So there are three or four periods, phases, rather like the analogies, it's a microcosm, macrocosm analogy, like persons growing up. Humanity, whether altogether, which is a more simple-minded version, or the separate countries, go through stages which are like the stages from childhood to adolescence to middle age and so forth, and that you have to get through the stages. I mean, you can't become an old man in one jump. I mean, you can't become a mature country with that I call linear. Marxism illustrates it, and it's, so to speak, a secular version of there being some redemption of the whole historical process, whether as Marxism by ascending to free socialism finally where all men are equal, or in Christian doctrines of some second coming or the kingdom of heaven and so on, which are sort of chiliastic doctrines of in 1,000 years people will arrive. Now those are all linear doctrines. What they're contrasted with, I think, are doctrines such as, for example, Arnold Toynbee had, which were general theories of history, which said, but rather more on a kind of medical analogy, that you can generalize there are certain conditions when societies decay and go into decadence and they have the successful time, the flourishing and their childhood. But this happens to different societies in no very correlated way, and there are general observations you can make. There are various cyclical theories of that kind. I mean, ancient historians had them, which aren't linear, but theories of decadence. I mean, empires rise and fall, British Empire, Roman Empire, Spanish Empire, these rose and fall, and they all do rise and fall sooner or later, but not in any very organized way. I mean, in the sense of an overall pattern, the general process isn't one of a teleological kind. There's no sense in it, no direction. That's what I meant.
Certainly the problem of linearity in history and the theological interpretation of Marxism in particular, I think that there are some elements in Marxism which you do not account for, and in particular the elements which, as you said, are left unknown, especially the re-emergent and latent modes of production which might all of a sudden emerge and affect the development of a certain society afterwards. And I think Marxism does account for that. Concerning the problem of, and this is my second question, concerning the problem of evolution of history, aren't you following in that just somehow or other Foucault's conception of the small breaks in history?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the last bit?
Epistemological breaks in the evolution, yes, of history, Foucault's conception of which will become actually to a certain extent very cyclical. The other question is concerning chance in history. If we believe that there is no linearity,
we'll have two questions or not. Yeah. Two questions or not.
Oh, I see, sorry.
Well, the question is again about linearity and Foucault's conception that there are these epistemological breaks in history, and that may be some form of pattern. Of course, when I speak of linear conceptions of history, I suppose I mean a kind of assumption that one carries around in one's head, rather than a very well worked out theory. Now, there are different theories which you can impose on the past, and provided you're a pluralist in the sense that you say, well, there's Foucault's theory, there's the way Levi-Strauss looks at different societies, all these are enlightening, but they don't really have any prophetic ring. Marxism has a prophetic ring because it says you will emerge into the domain of freedom. It says that. And that makes it a prophecy in the old sense of it being more than, making a claim, more than this is a useful way of coming to understand the past, or more important, to understand your own contemporary events. I mean, Marxism yielded some very good insights in, I don't wish to depreciate it beyond, for example, I remember in there was a thing called the October Club, which you won't be surprised here, it was a communist club in Oxford. And I remember John Strachey, who was subsequently a Labour minister and was a friend of mine, but not at this time, addressing it. And this was about, I suppose, 33 or 34. And he said, there's only one way in which late capitalism can work, and that is by self-liquidating public works. Now, what are self-liquidating public works? The answer is armaments. Why are they self-liquidating? Because you don't need to sell them. You don't need to have a market for them. You don't even need to know whether they work. All you need to know is that they're obsolete next year. Well, that wasn't bad. Yes.
Could you elaborate briefly on your meeting with your counterpart from Poland and the conclusions to which you came?
Yes. It really rather depends on...
May I ask you to repeat the question?
I was asked to elaborate on the meeting with Kolakowski and the conclusions we came to, or rather the conference, I suppose, came to. He's alive, well, and young, and therefore I must comes often to the United States and is a fellow of All Souls College, And I'm a little embarrassed to sort of talk beyond a certain point about him, because he might, I don't know, somehow there's a limit to it. But he was at that time and remains very disgusted with the development of socialism, which for him, of course, meant Marxism. He was brought up as a communist in Poland. His father was a communist, and he was a communist in the sense that some of us might be Episcopalian or Baptist or something. He was brought up in it. And we came to the conclusion that we couldn't get agreement among all of us there. I mean, there were people from Italy, Germany, France, the United States, Michael Harrington, various people from all over. And we discussed such issues as nationalism and so on, but we didn't agree anything. We ended in a terrible pessimism, I think, at least Leszek Kolakowski and I did, and I dare say some others, about the running out of this thought. After all, Marxism was a considerable body of thought, and there was no sign of any real development of it of a very interesting kind. If at all, it was from the Yugoslavs. There's a Yugoslav group who have attempted to develop a theory of libertarian communism, and to some degree the ideas have had practical tests. But I really can't say much more than that. We argued, some of us being more pessimistic than others, and then the two conveners being particularly pessimistic.
Is there a question behind the bar? The back? That's you on the left. Yeah.
Yes, well, I it'd be very inconsistent of me to have... Oh. I was asked to comment on the decline... I really must stop that. On the decline of socialist ideas since the war, and I'm pessimistic, could I give some reasons to why they've declined? Now, it would be very contradictory of me, inconsistent of me, to give any very precise reasons, for just because no reasons could be given of a causal kind without some theoretical backing, and I'm a little skeptical now of such theoretical backings. But I do think that I mustn't, it would be not faithful to what I believe, to say that I'm entirely pessimistic. First, on the facts that the immediate post-war government in England did achieve quite a lot along the lines that had been projected. That, so to speak, the thoughts of previous socialist thinkers had an effect. They got into action. The whole conception of the health service, the welfare services, and so forth, particularly the welfare services in detail, and the elimination of various features, perhaps peculiar to England, of class division, really did make an impact. So it's in that sense, I mustn't appreciate that. Secondly, on the future, I really do believe that there is a... But this is simply a belief, and I wouldn't wish it to be taken. Perhaps there's no risk of it being taken seriously, but I certainly wouldn't wish it to be. That the tide does, that there is something called fashion, which is thought to be superficial, but it isn't, I think. I think that because it's associated with clothes and externals, it's thought to be a superficial phenomenon. But it's only superficial in the sense in which Wilde rightly said, that those are truly shallow who despise appearances. That it's not really superficial. Because if you think of the arts, particularly the art, the visual arts, or architecture for the matter of that day, there is a swing that occurs. It's a natural way that human group life progresses, that it progresses by a kind of tidal in and out. And hence, I don't really believe that the things that are now happening, which seem very baleful and terrible in the sense that you might feel locked in, like Europe in 1815, got to put up with Metternich to 1848, that sort of feeling. I think it would be a mistake to feel that. I think that now there's the acceleration of public communications is such that the effect of things, like the miners' strike in England, come back very quickly, much more quickly than they did, and that although there is a dearth of original thinking of alternatives to conventional conservatism or prevailing conservatism, I think that nonetheless the sentiment for it exists. So I'm not in that sense pessimistic, but I do think there is ground for pessimism in the probable future development of the economy in this non-factory age. I think that that really does put a challenge on education of a very severe kind indeed, that something has to be thought out as to how you can prevent a division into two nations.
Oh, we'll have one more. Who has the best question? Thank you.
Just picking up on that point, wouldn't you want to make a little bit stronger argument? Namely that if you take liberalism and socialism as being in some sense guided by, directed by a linear conception of history, namely that they have ambitions that they want to work out. If you take conservatism as being a more
yes.
And practical oriented philosophy, namely that you will deal in a pragmatic way with immediacies. Would taking your own argument about the impossibility of prediction in social sciences, therefore the possibility of any kind of reasonable theories and successful policies, does not make good sense that we're all kind of conservative?
Well, I see the argument. Did everybody hear it? Okay. The argument was, if I say that liberalism and socialism depends upon the power to predict and hence to plan in their different ways, one more plan than the other, nonetheless, they have some doctrine of progress in the case of John Stuart Mill and in the case... while conservatives have a pragmatic, that wasn't the word used, but I think that's what was meant, deal with problems as they arise in a skeptical way. Isn't that an argument for conservatism that I've produced? Well, that is an argument used by conservatives, but it's an argument after the... it's used by Badgett, for example, an English conservative who's much quoted by English conservatives. But the fact is that what you find in conservative policy is that the rich get richer, the poor poorer. I mean that these elaborate epistemological justifications bear no relation to what actually happens, or very little relation. That is, they do not deal with problems as they arise. They are not dealing with educational problems. They are not dealing with a very severe problem in my country of the mounting cost of educational, of medical services and so forth because of the new machinery and so forth, and thus the half breakdown of the, or the threatened breakdown of the National Health Service. They are not dealing with any of these problems which actually affect people. I mean, people can write essays saying we're very pragmatic and we're very skeptical and we deal with problems as they arise. But if you actually what they're dealing with, is not at all what they're doing, is that vast fortunes are being made in the City of London as they sell off various public utilities and so forth. I mean, the actual realities are the economic changes. They're not dealing with actual administrative human needs, which do, of course, depend on people paying taxes and some redistributive taxation and other things which conservatives do not like. So, although I think it's an effective bit of rhetoric, I don't, and furthermore, one with a very respectable ancestry, and I don't, in fact, find myself persuaded by it.
I'm going to ask Professor Stephen Savitt, member of the professor in the Department of Philosophy at UBC, to thank our speaker on our behalf, on the behalf of Simon Fraser and the University of British Columbia. It's charged.
Well, despite the marked broadening of analytic philosophy in the post-war period that Professor Hampshire mentioned, there really are very few academic philosophers who are eminent in the technical profession who are yet also able to engage a wider public on issues of general intellectual concern. Professor Hampshire is surely one of the splendid, eloquent exceptions. I thank him for coming, and I hope we'll all thank him for coming.
We next week have Dr. David Huppel, the Department of Neurobiology of the Harvard School of Medicine, who will speak on the 16th of March at 8:15 to the title, Vision and the Brain. I welcome your attendance.